Hello and welcome to Charity Pulse, your bi-weekly dive into the heart of the charity sector. I'm Catherine Rastomji, Partner and Head of Charities at Shakespeare Martineau, and I'm delighted to be joined by my regular co-hosts, James Saunders, Partner at Moore Kingston Smith, and Charles Mosquita, Charities Director at Quilter Cheviot. Together we explore the latest insights and pressing issues affecting charities, non-profit organisations and the voluntary sector. So starting with this week's session. James, I was quite surprised from our previous discussions where we talked about gift aid fraud being comparatively rare compared to other types of fraud in the charity sector. And then shortly afterwards, I saw a case relating to two sisters who've been jailed for a combined 5.5 years for fraudulently claiming over £500,000 in gift aid. They admitted stealing the money over a 6-year period and they were girl guiding volunteers. I found it quite boggling that they managed it and managed to not be discovered for such a period. But I wondered, did you have any particular thoughts having seen the case?
Yeah, I wondered actually whether the case might have instigated the HMRC attention in the first place, or what was one of some that had. It's been going on for some time. And importantly, there wasn't charity money stolen. This is gift aid fraud. So they've made claims, gift aid claims, and then basically, and taken the money from the gift aid account, if you like. So their crime was against the government and HMRC rather than necessarily the charity, which it doesn't lessen the crime, but it does. It's important that it's not charity money specifically that's been stolen here. However, it does talk to that point that we have raised or talked about in the last couple of sessions about it's gift aid. To me, it brings together gift aid and banking. The gift aid system is actually fundamentally done on trust to a large extent. HMRC trusts charities to make honest claims. And if it has reason to doubt those claims, it will investigate. But there's no active process to review those claims. So I can see how this might have gone on. It's slightly surprising that the amounts are so large, but you can see how this happened. And bringing back the other point about the point about banking, it's checks, identities of other volunteers to sign off checks, apparently was one of the methods of enacting this fraud. So those controls around online banking stuff are all irrelevant when it comes to just the signature. And as we know, signatories on mandates can be out of date very easily. Very difficult for charities to update these things, as we've spoken about other times, and get the right people and more, their current trustees onto bank mandates. So it's both sides. It's the gift aid fraud that we said happens, but rarely. Well, this is a big occurrence, and also more relevant and more prevalent really is, there's lack of controls at the bank.
Yeah, and I think on that banking point, we've seen a report published this week, Charity Banking Challenges 2024, and it said nearly all the respondents, 92%, have experienced at least one difficulty related to banking in the past 2 years. So Charles, I don't know if you'd picked out any particular headlines from that report.
Yeah, I initially, when we've spoken about this before, I thought that this was all around anti-money laundering and we talked about the complexity and I think that case of 100 trustees, which none of us have ever come across, let alone 25 trustees. It was interesting. I was at a conference in Belfast organised by Northern Ireland Voluntary Organisations, NICVA, and they had somebody speaking on about banking. And it seems to be the biggest problem is that the staff within banks are not trained properly, so they don't have any understanding of charities whatsoever, which is creating all sorts of problems around it on their constitutions. But also I think they've automated a lot of stuff, which goes back to that AI comment I think we had previously. And of course, none of it's designed with charities in mind. I mean, this is just so typical from the past. So You know, I think the banking industry needs to actually turn around and say, what are the issues? And then how do we resolve it? I think there needs to have a can-do attitude here, because, you know, it is absolutely iniquitous that organizations shouldn't have access to banking. And there is no excuse about complexity, because they're not as that complex, in the respect that you've probably got three main different sort of constitutions. And these are things that are all surmountable. We deal with it as businesses dealing with charities, so why shouldn't banks?
Yeah, I find it really interesting. This week it was the Charity Commission annual public meeting, and they had one of their board members on, and I forget his particular name, but very experienced as a, you know, business entrepreneur and operating in different sectors. He gave the example of being a trustee needing to update the bank mandate, and he has done it twice so far and it's been rejected by the bank both times, and he was saying, I have no idea why that is the case. And it is this kind of, it's a law unto themselves. And I find, you know, since COVID we've seen other sectors and organisations adapt and allow electronic signatures, allow, you know, much more interaction online rather than you must physically appear in a branch, you must, you know, bring an ink signature to be able to proceed with it. So, James, I don't know if that's the experience of your clients as well, any difficulties on the banking side?
Absolutely. I mean, just this week, exactly that, you know, desperately trying to get the bank mandates updated, been trying for, I mean, it's years, it's not just months, years to get bank mandates. And what I would say is the banks are, if they're not allowing the bank mandate to be updated, then they are inadvertently, if you like, allowing your failures in control. If you've got a bank mandate that where there's a signatory from a trustee from who hasn't been a trustee for 2 years, you're effectively allowing someone who has no responsibility in the charity to be responsible for the charity's money. Which is, you know, it feels like the tail wagging the dog here. You know, the AML procedures or the updating procedures counter the real security issues over the control of the money. And that really is a major problem. It's also, I find it paradoxical in so many ways that updating online access to banks, online banking, is really easy for charities, you know, as easy as it is for everyone else. So you can put as many users on online banking as you want. If you are the main controller of the online account or the online super user or whatever it is, whereas changing the mandate is virtually impossible. And that is a real issue. And I think, to be honest with you, an awful lot of people don't anymore really understand the difference between the mandate, which is the overriding contract, if you like, with the bank and sets out the, you know, absolutely. And then there is the online access, which is the Wild West, frankly, in comparison.
It's frightening, isn't it? I think, but it entirely, you know, mirrors my observations of it. And also I'm a chair of trustees and I've taken on the task of updating the bank mandate. I thought I am going to see this through to the end, but my goodness, it was just a ridiculous process. But yes, we have done it now, and I never, ever, ever want to do it again. So, yeah.
I think one of the biggest problems, isn't it, is you can't deal with a human being and have a conversation to find out what the problem is. And that was the biggest, I suppose, point that was made at this conference, was that, you know, they'd send information in, it was like going into a black hole, and nobody would come back and tell them what the problem was. So, yeah. Which I think is a real, I don't understand why the banks are doing this, other than if it's been driven by profit and what they see as efficiency.
It's particularly relevant. I mean, which, you know, it's charity fraud awareness week at the moment. But I've heard from other clients that there's been an increase in these what they call mass attack. Cyber hacking efforts on credit cards. I think there was a very big one recently, the mass attack, where the hackers just go randomly through as many numbers as they can, as quickly as they can, I think, to try and match accounts with password and all that sort of thing. But there is some, that's on the up again. So anyone with any charities with any credit cards need to be aware of that particularly heightened risk at the moment. I mean, but these things come in phases, don't they? This is just the one that's particularly relevant in this month or two.
Interesting. Yeah, I thought of you this week, James, for Fraud Awareness Week. But my moment this week was the final publication of the Charity Commission inquiry report into the Captain Tom Foundation. It was a shame it was a day I had to work rather than a day I just wanted to sit on the sofa and devour every word of the report to see what's been going on. It did take 2 years for the Charity Commission to investigate and publish. It is complex, though. I mean, there's a lot in there in terms of how it was structured. Two disqualifications of the, I suppose, primarily the founding trustees, which we already knew because that had been announced previously, but some shocking things in there about, unauthorized trustee benefit, not acting in the charity's best interest, fraudulent misrepresentation. There's everything and then some in that report. And I suppose in general, my sadness at reading it is the possible damage to public trust and confidence in charities generally. But I think this, similar to Kids Company, is a blip. It is not reflective of the sector. But I'd be interested, Charles, I'll come to you first, whether you had any particular thoughts looking at it.
I mean, Captain Tom will be turning in his grave, won't he? I mean, this is just absolutely shocking. I mean, the thing I took from positive was it the Charity Commission, I think, has produced, I mean, I've taken a bit of time, admittedly, but a very robust report. I did ask myself the question of, so what happened with the money that they benefited for? Are they going to go after that? Because they should, and make an example of this. I mean, I know people are worrying about trust and confidence, but actually it's at an all-time high. These things happen, and you're never going to have a perfect world. And this is really a very unusual case. And actually, they have made an example of it. You've just got two people who've just, they've looked at a charity status and gone, oh, we can make lots of money, which is what it seems to me, without understanding there are a whole lot of controls and protocols around it, and they've been found wanting. I think the real disappointment is that neither of them seem to be terribly repentant about what they have done. And I mean, obviously don't know the individuals concerned, but I just think her father would be ashamed of what has happened in his name.
I find it quite incredible. They said they had been advised by professionals, and I thought, well, professional what? Because I have no idea who would advise you to do this in this way and think that that's compliant. James, I don't know if you had any particular concern.
I would imagine in some world somewhere that might be an interpretation where it might be compliant. But I mean, ethically, if you like, morally, there's just no case whatsoever. It's really disappointing. And actually, I take your point, Charles, that it's a blip, but it's a really high profile one, and it's excessively impactful, I think, because of Captain Tom and his efforts, how he was received in a particularly difficult time for the country. And then this squalid episode that's come on afterwards about, I just, we just want to make as much money. But, it's very evident. It's been very clear. This whole, the spa being built, I mean, it couldn't be any clearer. This isn't a technical area around, well, it's related party transactions and it's, duties with one hat on and one. But building the spa was just a horrible, a horrible example of abuse of power, money, and lack of morality. So yeah, it's pretty. I think that this will go on for some time. I think it has damaged confidence in charities.
But I think we do need to acknowledge, I mean, the charity sector is very good at, I think, at identifying these issues, looking at and analysing them, putting them in the public and being open about it, and then addressing them to make sure they don't happen going forward. So, these are really rare circumstances. I mean, this is just people who are just, quite frankly, taking the mickey.
The other difficulty, of course, is that no one seems to be particularly keen on chasing them for repayment of the funds.
Well,
And other than the charity, the original charity asking them to repay it, the police aren't interested. Charity Commission's not interested. They've left it to the charity itself to pursue the money, which, Catherine, I think you said was basically one trustee, which is, that doesn't seem particularly fair. If you've decided that everything's wrong, as the regulator, I would have thought they should have, taken the next step and gone after them.
yeah, because that's the only bit I think in the report. Some would say it is a robust report. It is in places, but the bit about there isn't any repayment, and the Charity Commission said they repeatedly urged the two trustees to do the right thing. And you think, well, if that was an issue for them, we wouldn't be in this position in the first place. So that's not going to work as a tactic. I thought
yeah, appealing to their better nature. That's that horse has bolted, well, hasn't it, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But perhaps that's what we should be calling for then, is the Charity Commission actually need to pursue this and to recoup the, as much money as they possibly can. You know, they've asked politely, now is the time to just to say, tough, you've behaved badly, now you've got to pay, because they should not be profiting from this, which is clearly, you know, people behaving extraordinarily badly and not in any way that is justifiable.
So I think,
and I do think they, Catherine, they'd have been much better off, wouldn't they, saying, okay, we got some bad advice, if you like, we you know, we misinterpreted it, we can see our problems, you know, full of remorse. That to me, would, they might have got away with this, but now they just look terrible.
Yeah, they really look terrible. I mean, yeah. And if in doubt, don't issue a press release. Seems press release after press release. That's not how we communicate in the charity sector. I think it's just, yeah, odd. But maybe that's a recommendation we'll make to Orlando Fraser, who is the chair of the Charity Commission and announced this week that he will be stepping down in April next year. And I think as a chair, we've commented on him before. I think he's set a fantastic tone. He's been very clear in his communications, seems to be working very well with the new chief executive, David Holdsworth. So I suppose just, you know, some further change at the Charity Commission. And we know that that does have that ripple effect of a different chair has a different emphasis and approach. Any thoughts, Charles, on what the new chair needs to do, or, you know, changes at the Charity Commission?
Yeah, I was sort of slightly surprised he was stepping down. It came out completely out of the blue. You know, I think he's done a fantastic job. He certainly set a much better tone than Baroness Stowell, his predecessor. And I think the commission is in a much better place following his tenure. I hope that they find somebody of similar caliber. The one interesting comment Orlando made a number of years ago was about having somebody who's who comes with a legal background. And I actually think from a regulator's point of view, that's probably not a bad thing. I think his expertise is around commercial law, but I think that has certainly added a depth. And yeah, David Holdsworth seemed to be, you know, starting off on the right foot. And seems to be doing a good job. So the appointment is really important, and I hope they just find the right person.
Yeah. I almost felt you're suggesting I should go for it, Charles.
Well, I think
I was going to say someone gobby.
Gobby, legal, yes.
Someone, yeah, a little bit more soapboxy. I'm thinking of someone in particular. I think your first point there, Charles, was right. And it's a bit like when we talk about charities in general, and you know, that CEO and chairman relationship is massively important. You know, you've got to work together. You've got to have the same ideas. You've got to be culturally similar. You know, not identikit, but if to have a close working relationship that's really productive, that relationship between CEO and chair, particularly here, is very important. The Charity Commission's got challenges. There's no doubt about it, and it's got a challenging time coming up as well. But we keep talking about the differences compared to only 5 years, 10 years ago, the size of the Charity Commission, what its responsibilities are, and that is not a static organisation at the moment. So it's really important. Yes,
definitely. Well, thank you both. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of Charity Pulse. We hope you found our discussion insightful. If you do have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. You know, please get in touch. We share our posts on various podcast platforms and also on our own firm's websites and LinkedIn. So different ways that you could get involved. And we hope to have you join us on future sessions of Charity Pulse. Thank you.